It is, I think, testimony to how productive the conference has been that I threw out my PowerPoint slides last night because I'd heard so much interesting stuff I wanted to engage in that my constant efforts to update them with things that people had said was proving futile. So the PowerPoint will, in fact, come after the conference, and you're going to have to just listen to me instead. There's significant research that PowerPoint has some negative cognitive effects. In fact, the investigation to the Challenger disaster partly blamed PowerPoint briefings for the Challenger disaster. So even though this was necessity in a late night and interesting things I was hearing, I'm going to frame it in terms of cognitive efficacy. My day job is, of course, I'm a professor of political science, so I'm doing Paul Mill wargaming largely in a kind of instructional learning environment, but I've also worked at the policy shop of the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs, which taught me all kinds of things about policy making, much the same way that working in a sausage factory would teach you about what goes into sausages. And I work as an intel analyst for the Canadian government from time to time as well. And all of those have given somewhat different perspectives on how one might do Paul Mill wargaming well. So I have a series of points I want to make about my perspective on best practices. And I'd start with a point that was made, particularly in the Wargaming 101 session, for those of you who were at it at the very beginning of the conference, is that it's essentially you know what the heck you're trying to do before you engage in Paul Mill wargaming like any other. Are you trying to stress test existing ideas? Are you doing it as a kind of horizon scanning? Are you doing it for the purposes of generating new ideas for the policy process? Is it some combination of those? Is it meant to be analytical? Is it meant to be learning? Or frequently, there are those who would differentiate sharply between analytical wargaming and learning experiential wargaming. Often in the policy environment, you do not have the luxury of making that separation. There are things you want to try to understand better, but you also want the participants running through the process to learn something that they will bring to bear in the subsequent job performance, and you can't, in fact, have a perfect research design that has no learning component or a learning component in which you're not trying to learn something. You're trying to do them both at the same time. Is it your main show? Is it a centerpiece of what you're trying to do? Is it an alternative analysis in which you're just doing a kind of intellectual cross-training to see whether things you're generating primarily other ways work, think about them in different ways? And frequently, I find, particularly in the Washington, D.C. kind of think tank community, is it what I call game washing. I don't know if you know what greenwashing it is. It's when you wrap an idea in environmental things so that it sounds nice. Pink washing is when you wrap an idea in LGBT equality things to make it sound nice. Game washing is when you have something you want to make sellable in Washington, so you run a game about it, and then you put on your website that we've gamed Syria, we've gamed that, and we've proven that our policy recommendations are the only possible policy recommendation. So is it game washing? And there's an awful lot of game washing, particularly within government, but particularly in the sort of inside the Beltway policy NGO think tank community, and it's getting worse. The second thing I would say in terms of best practices is, do you need a game? Okay. And does it need to be a game war game, meet the Peter Perla definition of a game, which actually changed the last Connections US, so people all have to update their Peter Perla definitions, by the way. You're all using the old one, you're okay. Or does it have game elements in the context of something else? I am a big advocate about thinking about the kinds of techniques we're talking about at this conference as a toolkit. There's a variety of tools in that toolkit, and we ought to draw upon them to resolve or address particular problems, but we don't have to use all the things in the toolkit. There may be parts of it that are appropriate for particular kinds of problems. I'm also a big advocate of what you might term responsible evangelism. There are many cases where a game is not the best solution, and I find myself as frequently saying, no, don't game that. You could have a better bog sat. You could do it better this kind of way. I think we really need to think about when a game is bringing value added or when it doesn't. There is great opportunity cost in a game in terms of bringing people together, in terms of the investment, and in terms of the time you're not spending doing other kinds of stuff. As I said, I work as an intel analyst, sit down with other Five Eyes intel analysts on Middle East issues. Those are the best professional meetings I go to analytically. It would be a shame to take up 3, 4, 5 hours of that with a game, given how good those box set discussions are. Now, that is a function of the people who facilitate those sessions, and it's part of a long tradition of those having become very flat, non-hierarchical. There's a political culture around those meetings, which doesn't exist in all BOGSATs. Net result, though, is that that BOGSAT is actually better than gaming out the stuff, given that you can only have a bunch of Five Eyes analysts in town for a day or two because they're flying from all over the planet to be there. So I do think we have to be responsible in our evangelism for games. I'm a big fan of using games, but there are times when we have to say, no, actually, there are better ways of doing this. And I think particularly on Paul Mill things, because you can have very productive, there's a reason why we have graduate seminars. You can have really productive small group discussions on these kinds of issues. Do you need a big game? You need a big, complicated, expensive game. Frequently, you don't. You may need a big game because you have a lot of people you want to sell it to. You may need a big game because you want a lot of noise and impartial information. I ran a very large war termination exercise, sort of Civil War peace operation exercise or game at McGill. I've been running it for 15 years now. 120 participants, 12 hours a day, real time, 7 days. During terms, so the students are stressed out as hell. There's a reason, though, and that is because I'm doing a peace operation, which has to be characterized by high degrees of stress, imperfect information, a lot of fog of war, a lot of fog of peace, and a lot of noise. And so I want something noisy. So that's why it has to be big. But in other cases, you don't necessarily need big games. I've seen very simple Matrix games that have, in 3 hours, with limited prep, limited briefing, a small number of players, produced, I think, superior intellectual insights to much larger, much more complicated sort of three-move seminar games with large groups of participants. So do you need a big game, or in fact, is a quick and dirty game get you 75% of the result for 15% of the time and input and what have you? So I think we need to trade off game complexity and game detail. If you want to do Paul Mill gaming effectively, one of my next recommendation would be you have to read Crisis Gaming 27 Years Later, which is a collection of long letters that Tom Schelling and William Jones and Robert Levine at RAND wrote each other back in the 60s when we didn't have email, and therefore instead of having long threads on Phil simulating war email list, you actually wrote 17-page TypeScript letters to your colleagues down the road, down the building, who then wrote you back 7-page TypeScript letters, and someone unfortunately kept them on carbon paper. And it is about a 60-page collection of letters going around the building on the strengths and weaknesses of Paul Mill gaming. And there's almost nothing that is not in that collection. And that covers all the strengths and all the weaknesses. It's a very thoughtful debate. It's on the RAND website. It's called Crisis Gaming 27 Years Later. And you need to read it because, frankly, most of the issues I'm identifying are not new under the sun. In the golden age of RAND, Paul Mill, wargaming, they had very thoughtful discussions about the strengths and weaknesses of the approach. And we do not need to reinvent that particular wheel. Plus, it's fascinating that people had long email type exchanges before we had email. You need to think very carefully when you're Paul Mill gaming about how you structure participation, because the identity of the actors in the game has fundamental effects on outcome. You know, you're running a game on Syria, Iraq. Are the Turks at the table? Are the Turks not at the table? Are the Jordanians at the table? Are the Jordanians not at the table? How are you handling the Sunni the non-ISIL Sunni opposition in Iraq? Is it one actor? Is it two actors? Is it three actors? Is it no actors? Are you treating the Iraqi government as a unitary actor? Are you addressing the divisions within it, and so on and so forth? The game outcome is determined by who the players are in many cases, far more so than I think in a lot of strict military wargaming. Military wargaming is working in an environment where structure is a given. And for an organization, for entities that have a hierarchy fetish, right, which is the nature of military institutions. They're very structured. They know who's who, and they know what the units on the battlefield are. With Paul Mill wargaming, structure is theory. It's a model. It's ideology. Who actually matters? How are they constituted? How do they make decisions? We don't agree on those things. Is there something called the Iraqi government? Is there? Is there a thing called the Iraqi government, or is it a sort of loose collection of rivals flying in the same direction, as was once said of DC-3s? So that is not a clear point. It's not clear who the actors actually are. Is ISIL a single entity, or is it a series of decentralized commands with some ability to move strategic resources from theater to theater, but in fact operating autonomously on the battlefield? So in Palmill Gaming, the entities at the table are not clear. Indeed, they reflect the way in which you think about the problem. And you have to give a lot of thought to that. Moreover, typically, military wargaming, we have everyone participating in the same kind of way. A seat at the table is the same kind of thing for everyone. There may be hierarchy. You know, you may be the fleet commander, or you may be the captain of the destroyer, or what have you. But everyone's there in the same kind of way. Often with Palmill Gaming, you're dealing with a situation in which key drivers, key actors are kind of amorphous blobs. What do you do about refugees? Refugees fundamentally make decisions that shape the policy environment, for example, for the current European migration and refugee crisis. But they don't sit in a cell and decide on the refugee policy and then pass it on to the white cell and say, we're going to try and cross the border into Hungary. That's not how they do it. It's a decentralized decision by tens or hundreds of thousands of people operating due to a particular set of constraints and opportunities, but it fundamentally shapes the environment just as much as if you decide to run a train from Hungary to Austria or open the border or close the border. But you can't have them represented in the same way. I do a lot of refugee gaming because it's one of the areas I work, and you have to think about how are refugees going to be in the game, because you can't make them a team like the others. Do you have two separate games? So the refugees are doing a kind of respond to incentive and environment game in which they're trying to survive, and the output of that is the input to your policy game. Do you do it that way? Do you structure physical space? I ran a refugee policy simulation in which we had actual refugees from the camps, from Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, and everyone had a room, all the policy players had a room, and an intern, and comms gear, and everything, and the refugees were forced to wander the site without a place to stay. Which had two advantages. One, they were kind of hard to consult because you didn't know where they were. And the other was they got really pissed off with the rest of everyone else because they're sitting in these nice rooms, kind of like a policy, and they're looking for a chair. I knew the refugees, so I could do this to them, but I explained to them, I said, you know, no one comes to talk to you, so you guys have to literally wander the corridors and try and find, you can sit on the ground here if you want, or maybe go outside in the lawn. But that was because I wanted to not give the sense that refugees were policy actors like the Israelis or the Palestinians or the Americans or all the other people I had represented in that very high level policy environment. So you have to think creatively about how you're going to structure participation to deal with these kinds of problems. One of the things that Tom Schelling and his colleagues talk about is the idiosyncratic effects of player attitudes and styles and psychologies and ideologies in Palmill games. I think it's true in all games, but in Palmill games in particular. Now, there's a very positive element to that, which Ed McGrady talked about yesterday in terms of play, which Graham talked about in terms of player engagement, which Peter has hammered on in a lot of stuff he's written about the sort of getting the emotional commitment of players so that they really represent the kind of non-rational determinants of behavior in political crisis and so on and so forth. Natasha Gill has a new book on what she calls integrative simulations, which addresses this too. I think that's a very valuable part of the simulation process. It also means, though, that there's a great deal of variability in outcome depending on who your players are. And you have to recognize that when you're doing Palmill wargaming. Depending on their domain expertise, depending on their strategic sense, that is to say, how good they are at strategizing, and depending on how good they are at playing game systems, which I think is a different skill, how well they understand the way the game is going to operate and therefore what they can do within it in order to shape reality, you're going to get very different outcomes. Depending on their professional subcultures, you're going to get different outcomes. Experimental evidence suggests that military officers do not behave like normal people in games. They feel they have to do something, whether you should do something in the game or not. Experimental evidence suggests economists, when you do sort of economic experimentation, do not behave like normal people. The experimental evidence, in fact, is economists are only modeling themselves when they do economics because they're the only actual rational utility maximizers on the planet. But you have to take this into account, and you also have to recognize that in real life, people are embedded in institutional constraints which the game often frequently fails to portray. The president of Sylvania can do anything as he stands on the stairs making his speech. In real life, the president of Sylvania is part of a machinery of thousands which has standard operating procedures, bureaucratic requirements, resource constraints, and so on and so forth. And in fact, you are much less free to do whatever you want. And so our games often do not represent that institutional and bureaucratic and political constraint very effectively, and you have to think about that. Finally, the last point, and it's one that everyone has made and everyone will continue to make, you have to think about how you're going to capture, debrief, analyze, reflect upon, and particularly for polemical games about policy initiatives, continue to advocate for the ideas. Because all too often, you run the polemical game, it sits there, and then 2 months later, it's you know, it's just this piece of history. And then 6 months later, no one can find the report on the server anymore. And 7 months later, emailing people saying, did you have the final report from that? Because I thought I had a copy, but I must have accidentally deleted the email. And so on and so forth. You really do have to think about all those things, about how you're going to capture what happened, understand what happened, and make sure that what happened has some continuing influence in the process. Okay.